Technically Legal Podcast, Technology and the Law, Done Right, Podcast 4, for Tuesday, June 23rd. Hi everyone, my name is Ben Snitkoff, I'll be your host for today, and with me I've got...
Dominic Rabier.
And David O'Brien.
So the big news this week is the Jamie Thomas case. This is the second time this case has gone to trial. The first time it went to trial, it was 2007, and Jamie Thomas, a single mother who lives in Minnesota, was found liable for 24 counts of copyright infringement. She was ordered to pay $222,000 in damages. The judge in that case then reversed his own ruling, said that he instructed the jury incorrectly on what the controlling law was with copyright infringement, and we'll get into all of this in just a little bit. He ordered a new trial. The new trial closed just this Friday, and the RIAA was awarded $1,920,000 in damages for those same 24 songs. So there are a whole bunch of issues that are raised. First off, we're going to talk about the statutory damages scheme. Now, one commenter who's also a litigator in a lot of these cases, Ray Beckerman, thinks that the statutory damages were not properly proven in this case. Essentially, his argument is that in these cases, you have to prove that the copyright infringement, allegedly in this case, either downloading the songs off of Kazaa or redistributing them through Kazaa, that event has to happen after the copyright registration takes place in order for statutory damage to be applicable. But the RIAA in these cases aren't alleging specific dates of copyright infringement. Instead, what they're saying is that the infringement isn't one specific instance, it's this entire time. It's the time from when the person starts using Kazaa to when they stop using Kazaa, because this distribution, letting other people download the files from you, is also acts of copyright infringement. So I'm going to throw this to Dominic first. What would the RIAA have to prove in order to show that Jamie Thomas violated these after the copyrights were registered?
Violated what, sorry?
Violated the copyrights after the copyrights were registered.
They'd have to prove that the copyrights were registered and that she copied them in violation of those copyrights.
Okay, so what are
but
the
she
two...
violated one of the exclusive rights.
Right.
It could be either the right to distribute or the right to reproduce a copy.
Okay, are there other rights too?
There are. There are, I think, 5 or 6 rights. But you also have the right to publicly display and publicly perform, generally.
Okay, but those rights weren't at issue in this case. It was just the right to copy them and to distribute these songs, correct?
Right. Well, I mean, we're talking about music files here on a computer, MP3 files. So at issue specifically was the file sharing program and whether or not there had been some sort of actual violation of those exclusive rights. And obviously the two most likely would have been either making a unauthorized copy or distributing without authorization.
Now, the first time this went to trial, the judge thought that the jury had decided this on the right of distribution and ordered a new trial because the judge was under the impression that he misinformed the jury as to what the law was about distribution. Now, he re-instructed the jury in this case in what he thought was the proper way. How did the original jury instruction differ from this next the jury instruction in this case, and what are the implications of that, really?
Well, I'll take this first, and then Dominic can jump on with any comments you might have. The first jury instructions included an instruction that basically said, just by making available the files for download on a file sharing program, that alone could constitute copyright infringement, basically. So that is a very contentious and unsettled point of law. Most of the jurisdictions in the United States do not accept that as a valid theory, and the whole reasoning behind it is because if you have that, it basically says that you don't need to show actual evidence that anyone either received the file and downloaded it, or that any additional copies were made. So it's sort of an evidentiary problem to some extent. There have been a few jurisdictions that have sort of accepted it, in some cases not really openly. None of them have ever gone to trial, though, and so that's why this was such a big deal.
Okay, and in this case, how did that instruction differ?
You mean the new instruction?
Yes. How did the new instruction differ from the one?
The new instruction basically turned that around. So the judge had, after the last trial, the judge came out and raised what we call the sua sponte, which kind of means raising on your own accord, without any indication from either of the parties. The judge sort of came out and said, "I made a mistake. The jury instructions were incorrect." And this time around, after the new trial, so they retried the case, the jury instructions specifically said in two of the separate instructions, one, you can have copyright infringement where you have an unauthorized distribution, and two, you can have copyright infringement where there is a unauthorized reproduction.
Okay, but did the judge describe what he meant, what's meant by distribution? Trick question. Sorry, the answer is no. He didn't expound on that at all, which is one point of argument as to why this jury verdict may not stand either. Now, looking at the copyright statute again, this will be in the show notes. The right to distribution reads that the copyright owner has the exclusive right to, quote, distribute copies to the public by sale or transfer of ownership, by rental, lease, or lending. In my understanding, the only evidence they have of actual distribution was that Media Century, this company that the RAAA hired, did a search on Kazaa for these songs and downloaded them off of Jamie Thomas's computer, allegedly downloaded them off of Jamie Thomas's computer. But it seems to me that they wouldn't be to the public. This isn't a distribution to the public. This is a distribution to Media Century, a privileged party. What have the court said about that?
Well, this again popped up in the last decision where the judge came out and said, "I got the jury instructions wrong." And the parties had argued that when you have a company like Media Century, and Media Century, so we clarify, is this third-party company, and they are basically they're sort of like a private investigator for copyright infringements, and they have a variety of techniques of trying to sort of hunt down people who are infringing copyrights over various mediums. And there's this whole issue about whether or not, you know, if you have some sort of like private investigator, isn't it more like, you know, they're basically downloading these files at the direction of the copyright owner. In this case, that would be the record labels. The record labels go to Media Century. They say, "We want you to find, you know, copyright infringers." And so they've sort of authorized it. And under the way that we look at it from a legal stance, it could arguably be a authorized copying or an authorized distribution, then, since the record label has come forth and done that. That when the judge brought this up in his opinion, basically the law in the Eighth Circuit, which is where the court is sitting, says that it doesn't matter and it can still be a infringement even though it was authorized. It's a little unsettled in some other jurisdictions, but not many. A lot of jurisdictions also accept this. So it wasn't a huge surprise that the court came out on this side.
The jury instructions are actually pretty clear on this point. Jury instructions 18 and 19 in particular, they're just one sentence, and I'm just going to read them, that the act of downloading copyrighted sound recordings on a peer-to-peer network without license from the copyright owners violates the copyright owner's exclusive reproduction right. So there's that copyright, the reproduction right, and here the jury instruction says that any download of a music file or a sound recording on a peer-to-peer network without authorization or license from a copyright owner violates the reproduction right. And the next one says the same thing for distributing sound recordings over a peer-to-peer network.
Okay, so you're contending... So to violate the first one, though, they would have to have proved that Jamie Thomas actually downloaded the copyrighted song on a peer-to-peer network. Because that's the right of reproduction.
Not necessarily. Right. Well, not necessarily. I mean, it could be the case that she had a CD copy and made a copy onto her computer.
The plaintiffs weren't contending that ripping her CDs was copyright violation in this case. They were not arguing that.
Right. So they were saying that she had downloaded it to begin with?
So they just weren't arguing that point.
That's kind of my point, I guess, I'm making. It's very hard to prove that someone, the way that these Media Century, the Media Century company is going about this is they have a method of getting into the shared folder on the computer through which Kazaa is operating, and so they could see all the files, or some of them at least, that Jamie Thomas was supposedly sharing. they don't have any evidence that she actually downloaded them from anybody else. They just know that they're there. So that's another evidentiary problem in proving the reproduction right was violated.
Right. I'd like to point out that MediaCentury's method of getting into the shared folder is double-clicking on the username in Kazaa and going to look at their shared folder. It's not any type of magic that they used. So essentially, though, that the jury could have found Jeremy Thomas liable for this copyright infringement two ways. The first way is if the RAAA had shown that Jeremy Thomas downloaded these songs on a peer-to-peer network without a license. The second way is if she distributed these songs on a peer-to-peer network without a license.
And correct. The verdict form actually doesn't specify which that is. The verdict form basically walks the jury through three steps. The first step is, does the plaintiff own the copyright for the whole list of songs that were in question? The second step is just whether the defendant committed an act of infringement for each of those songs, and it's just a yes or no checkbox on each of the songs. And an act of infringement incorporates both the distribution right, which would be sharing it via the P2P network, and the reproduction right, which would be downloading it over a P2P network. It doesn't distinguish between which one it is, and we don't know what's in the mind of the jury. And the third question that the jury has to do is damages for each song, based on willfulness as well.
Right. So if the infringement was willful, the jury could grant significantly higher damages than if the infringement was not willful, if it was so-called innocent infringement. And in this case, the jury did find that the infringement was willful and awarded something along the lines of $80,000 per song copied.
Right.
Okay, so I guess that raises the next question of whether or not damages that large are constitutional.
Well, I want to get back first to a point that you made earlier about the registrations. I think if you look at the actual songs, and you can find a list of the songs that were at, there are 24 of them that were at issue in this case, you can go back and search through the copyright registrations and find that most of them have been registered well more than 10 years ago. I haven't done like some sort of exhaustive search where I found that all of them were definitely registered, but I'm pretty confident at least, that if you went back, you'd find that most of them were registered in a period of time prior to when these songs were actually downloaded or allegedly distributed.
Right, I don't disagree with that, but the issue is that the parties didn't stipulate to when they were registered, and the jury never found when they were registered, nor did the jury make any specific findings as to when the acts of copyright infringement took place. So while I don't think anyone would actually contest whether or not statutory damages are appropriate, the RAAA didn't prove that statutory damages were appropriate.
It's a burden-shifting process in the end, though. That was something that the defendant would probably have had to raise.
Why do you allege that the RAAA didn't prove that statutory damages were appropriate?
To the best of my knowledge, there was no evidence introduced at trial that the registrations were made before the acts of infringement took place.
Well, we don't really know. I mean, one way or another, I don't think we have seen the documents, and we certainly were not there in the courtroom, so we don't know if that was actually argued or not. It could very well have been argued, and the judge summarily dismissed it, that argument by the defendants, and said, these are, you know.
In the jury instructions, they state that as given that there were copyright notices on each of the compact disc containers for all of the 24 sound recordings. I'm not sure whether that goes directly to your point, Ben, but okay. That was in the jury instructions.
Can you not put a copyright notice on something if it hasn't been registered?
I know
you can't legally do that with trademark. Like, you can't use the circle R if something hasn't been registered.
Remember, as soon as something gets put in a fixed medium, it's copyrighted automatically.
There's a difference between a copyright accruing and a copyright being registered, though. If
right.
You can only get the statutory damages for after the copyright
one,
has
right.
been registered.
Yeah. You're correct there. Like, if I just have the magical instance of copyright, I can't sue someone over that. It has to be registered for me to sue someone over
it. Right. So there are two parts to that, actually. First, you have to register before you can bring a suit, and it has to be registered it has to be registered before the infringement happens if you want statutory damages. So I can make something in a fixed medium, like, say, this podcast, and if I don't register it and somebody makes an unauthorized copy of it tomorrow, I can register it the next day. I can register this on Thursday and sue the person for copyright infringement, but I can't get the statutory damages because at the time of the infringement, this wasn't registered. That is 17 USC, I want to say 412, and that'll be in the show notes too.
Though you can't get the damages, though, you can stop the person from using your content because
it still violates copyright.
You can't get statutory damages, but you can stop them from using
content. You could get equitable relief if equitable relief was available, and you could get regular damages that approximate, you know, whatever the harm would be.
Where equitable relief just means basically whatever's fair in the eyes of the court in terms of the harm you suffered.
Right. It would usually be the court saying you've got to stop illegally reproducing this and sending it out to people. But equitable relief can take a large number of forms.
Well, getting back on point, you know, I guess it could still potentially be an issue on appeal as to whether or not there was registration prior to the actual unlawful act.
Jury instruction 14 says that a plaintiff's certificates of registration of its copyright apparently is prima facie evidence of the element of ownership. And apparently the defendant said that the plaintiffs didn't own the songs, and the jury had to look at the evidence before it, and I'm not clear exactly what that evidence was to determine whether or not the plaintiffs actually did own the songs. I'm not sure whether any certificates of registration were actually put into evidence.
I would imagine they would have to be. So I think what that's saying is that the defendant didn't agree to the fact that the defendants owned the song, that the plaintiffs rather owned the songs. They wanted the RIAA to have to bring someone in and show the copyright certificate. So I guess if, depending on what media center he testified to, if the copyright registrations that they put into evidence, that they brought to court, showed when they were registered, and they were all registered long before, you know, the alleged infringement took place, that would be enough to show statutory damages.
I think so. That's my take on it.
Anybody else have comments on this before we move to whether or not these statutory damages are even constitutional?
I think we've pretty much settled that issue. Let's tackle the next one.
I think Ray Beckerman raised a valid point, but I don't think it's as significant as he made it out to be in the post, though.
Okay. So the next issue is whether or not these are constitutional. This is an argument that's really been championed by Charlie Nesson and Charlie Nesson's protege, Kiwi Camara. Am I pronouncing that right?
As far as I know.
Who ended up taking over the Jamie Thomas case right before this recent trial. And their argument is essentially that $80,000 of damages for copying one song, which would cost a dollar on the iTunes Music Store, now up to $1.29 on the iTunes Music Store, is so grossly disproportionate that it violates part of the Constitution called the Due Process Clause. Does anyone want to take the lead and, you know, kind of expound on that argument, what their views are?
I think the basic point, as I understand it, is that the damages must have some sort of reasonable relationship to the bad act. And in this case, you're looking at songs, which the actual cost of them is so low compared to the damages awarded per song that it is disproportionate to the harm that was in fact done.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's not unusual for damages to be more than the actual harm caused. It's not unusual at all in civil trials to have things called punitive damages, which is a way of, you know, let's say I get hit by a car by somebody driving very, very, very negligently. So the jury could award me the damages of, you know, fixing whatever injuries I got from being hit by the car, and then award something called punitive damages on top of that, which is a way of saying to the defendant in that case, you hit him with the car and it was such a bad act on your part that we're going to punish you more in an effort to try to deter you from doing this again.
Right. In some sense, it's a deterrence mechanism because we want people to sort of fear these types of things and hope that they will not want to do those unlawful acts in the future.
Mm-hmm. It's important to distinguish, though, between punitive damages and statutory damages, because the Supreme Court has spoken pretty clearly that grossly excessive punitive damages awards do violate the Due Process Clause of the Constitution, but it hasn't really said anything about grossly excessive statutory damage awards, whatever those might be. Statutory damages are basically in the law, but like Congress has written that this is the range for damages. They passed the law. I'm not entirely sure what argument you would use to say that something that Congress has passed violates the due process clause of the Constitution in terms of the damage amount. But for what it's worth, the three standards that the Supreme Court laid out in terms of determining what is a grossly excessive punitive damage award, they basically set this out in a case where a jury apparently awarded a $2 million award against BMW because a guy sued BMW because he bought a car, and it turned out the car had been repainted. And the Supreme Court said, well, $2 million for finding out your car is repainted is grossly excessive, because the first factor is how bad were the defendant's acts. In this case, the car was repainted. That's bad, but it's not terribly bad. The disparity between the harm to the plaintiff and the punitive award, just finding out that your car has been repainted doesn't really cause you $2 million worth of damages. That's a pretty large disparity between the harm you suffer and the award in this case. And then finally, the similarity between the award and whatever civil penalties normally would happen. Just finding out that your car is repainted, again, $2 million, that difference, that disparity between what you would normally be able to get in terms of contractual violations, the value of the car itself, that disparity is pretty big. It's an open question to see whether the Supreme Court will take those standards from grossly excessive punitive damage awards and apply them to statutory damage awards, where I'm not sure what there has been any jurisprudence in terms of grossly excessive statutory damage awards.
Right. One thing that I'd like to point out, you left this out when you were describing it. A guy thought he was buying a new BMW, and it turned out that BMW repainted a used car and sold it to him as if it were a new car. So,
yeah, sorry to not make that clear.
Yeah. But I agree. The jurisprudence is usually on the cases that deal with this have all been punitive damages cases, and the Supreme Court has made two additional rulings. One is that generally, this is a guideline, it's not firm. Punitive damages should not exceed 10 times what the regular penalties were. So if I, in that car crash scenario, if I had broken my leg and, you know, pain and suffering and the hospital bills and, you know, however large my lost wages were, say that was $10,000, I could get $10,000 for the recovery and then another $100,000 for punitive damages. But anything more than that, the Supreme Court generally holds as grossly excessive. And there's been some leeway in there. It depends on the other factors that Dominic just listed. The other thing that the Supreme Court has said is that when determining punitive damages, you can't look to other plaintiffs. You can't look to the harm that was caused to other prospective plaintiffs. So in a case like Jamie Thomas's, it would be improper to punish Jamie Thomas for the acts of other people, or to punish Jamie Thomas for other harm caused to the RIAA or other copyright holders for similar acts.
I think you get into a funny area here, and that's what we're really talking about is the right to distribute. And so she made this file or these files, the 24 songs, available for distribution over the file sharing network, and we don't know, and as far as we could tell, the RIAA does not know how far that those were distributed, how many other people came around and downloaded those songs. We don't know how many copies went out there and became rampant in the wild, in other words.
Right. We don't know that. So I guess extending this argument, you've got to wonder, first, if it's legal for the RIAA to try to punish Jamie Thomas for other downloaders to, you know, use, not only just use her case as an example, but to try to extract more punishment from her in order to deter other people, as opposed to just deterring Jamie Thomas from doing this again.
I think it's a tough case to make, because, I mean, you were really distinguishing here the right to reproduce or to make a copy from the right to distribute. And it's tough in these cases where you have these file sharing programs, because you just don't know how much it got out there. And potentially, the amount of infringement that took place after she made that file or those files available is exponential, because one person gets it, and you don't know how many people that the second person was able to let it out to or make it available to.
That's true, but at the same time, Jamie Thomas, while she certainly had a part in these other possible distributions, there's somebody on the other end of that distribution who also was downloading a song illegally off of Kazaa. So is it appropriate for the RIAA to be going after Jamie Thomas for all of these distributions that they don't have any evidence of? Wouldn't it be better for the Media Century person to have, you know, search more files and try to get all of the names of people who had downloaded those and sue them individually?
I suppose that the argument is that the statutory damages then might bear some relationship on the right to distribute, only because you don't know how many people the song actually was distributed to or how many distributions there were. And that would bear mostly on the defendant in this case, Jamie Thomas.
But if we go back then to the not exactly perfect parallel of the punitive damages, I should be able to recover against the guy who hit me for all of the people he also may have hit because he was driving so recklessly. And that just doesn't...
It's a hard argument to make, though, because now we're distinguishing statutory damages from punitive damages. And so those are kind of two separate cases, I think.
I totally agree. It's not a perfect analogy. Going back to what Dominic said, though, about whether or not these are constitutional, and I think this is the core of the issue. And Dominic, you managed to echo something that I said to David yesterday, which was that the essence of this kind of due process challenge is that the law was somehow violated by, I don't know if I can describe this without using the word due process, without, you know, the proper workings of the legal system. So your typical due process claim is something along the lines of you're being denied welfare benefits because your welfare benefits were, you know, denied or canceled without a fair hearing. You lost a right or a privilege that you've earned without an ability to contest that in front of a judge. And juries work in that same way. You know, you have a trial and the jury does whatever they want afterward. And the court has found that sometimes juries go so far off the rails that it amounts to a due process violation when they give these huge verdicts. But I agree with Dominic in general in that it's very hard to make the argument that somehow Congress, going through the legislative process, they were duly elected, they passed a law, it was passed by the other House of Congress and signed by the President. It's hard to say that there's an inherent lack of, you know, proper workings of the legal system there. That's checks and balances at its finest.
Another issue I'd want to explore in this case is why the jury came back with this rather large amount. I mean, what would motivate a jury to go for $80,000 a song?
Oh, we could speculate forever. It could be that the jury was angry or that the jury really, you know, disliked the defendant or something like that. Or who knows? It could be something else entirely.
Am I correct to say that the defendant alleged innocence throughout the whole trial?
I believe that's what the angle was, that it was innocence. Also, the defendant got caught in a series of inconsistencies with her prior testimony, and that's never going to make a jury like you. Another thing that happened was there are reports that her attorney was not well-liked among people in the courtroom. He was kind of cocky and flippant the entire time. And all of these are things that, you know, would sour the jury to the defendant and the defendant's attorney and could make them return a verdict that's so huge and indeed, I mean, so disproportionate to the jury that was returned in the first trial.
When the jury comes back, though, with a verdict like this, the judge has he's able to reduce the amount awarded, though, and he did not do that in this case.
Well, he hasn't ruled on that yet, and he can't flat out reduce it. What he can do is do something called remitter, which he essentially goes to the plaintiff and says, listen, plaintiff, we're going to do something. You can either accept a lower value for this, or you can do a new trial. And the plaintiff has that choice. They can either accept the lower value that the judge thinks is appropriate, or they can go for the new trial. Again, those usually happen in cases where statutory damages aren't an issue. It's very hard for the judge to make the argument that a damage amount that's authorized by statute was inappropriate, grossly disproportionate to the actual harm suffered. If nobody else has, let me throw that open. Anybody else have other topics they want to discuss about that? We've been on it for about a half hour now.
I think we're good for now.
David?
I don't really have anything new to add, but you know, I think this will be an interesting issue. I mean, we have to remember this is the first case involving the RIA sort of versus the people that has actually gone to trial and the first jury award that we've seen yet, so there's a lot of unknowns.
Yes, and it was the first jury, it was the first case to go to trial and the first jury award the first time this trial went in 2007.
Right.
So, yeah, and just to make it clear, there are a lot of avenues that the defendants can, that the defendant, singular, can pursue now. There are all sorts of motions that they can file. They've still got a right of appeal. So it's unlikely that this litigation will end anytime soon.
Ray Beckerman, actually, before I forget, he raised another interesting argument in a separate blog post, and that was that it maybe the jury should have been instructed that rather than individual songs that would each have their own statutory damages amount tied to them, that the works in question could have constituted actual albums. So rather than one song being worth $80,000, maybe it should have been more like every 12 songs should have been worth $80,000 as a composition of a work.
Right, and there were actually multiple songs that came off of one album. So
right.
I think that's more apt in those cases. I think there were two or three Journey songs that came off the same album. So those could have been one work. And I think that would be determined on the basis of how the copyright was registered. And I don't know what the standard is in the music industry, if you register each song individually or if you register the album as a whole.
Or if you could do both, even.
Yeah, although
have a
I don't
separate
know.
Registration for each song and then a separate registration for the album as a whole, or
I don't know what you'd gain by doing that. If you register each of them individually, I can't see what you would gain from registering the album as a whole. I mean, I guess you could say that it's another, if somebody copies the entire album, you've got, you know, 12 counts of copyright infringement and then another count for the entire album. It's just a little weird.
Covers all bases, I guess.
I don't know. That's fair. Okay, so the next big story that we've got is the Microsoft and the EU. So Microsoft's been embroiled in antitrust problems in the EU for a very long time, and just to be clear, that's the European Union, and they had their own antitrust problems in the United States, but those settled a few years ago. So in 2004, Microsoft had a series of problems with the European Union relating to whether or not Microsoft bundling Windows Media Player with Windows was appropriate, and whether or not it unduly restricted other media players and other, you know, media formats from gaining traction in Europe. And that came to a conclusion that the European Union did not like. Essentially what happened is Microsoft offered one version of Windows at full price without Windows Media Player, without all of the things that come with Windows Media Player, and offered another version of Windows that was normal Windows. So you could have, you know, a crippled version of Windows and you could have a non-crippled version of Windows for the same price. And now, this litigation relates to essentially what the U.S. antitrust litigation related to Windows and Microsoft bundling Internet Explorer with Windows and whether or not that exerted, whether or not that hurt competition in the browser market and whether or not that's still hurting competition in the browser market. So, Dominic or David, could you explain to us a little bit about the U.S. antitrust litigation and how that relates to the EU?
The old U.S. antitrust litigation that Netscape basically had brought about ages ago, that one?
Yes.
This is sort of round two, except for in Europe. Instead of Netscape suing, we have Opera bringing a complaint. Opera is a maker of a browser called Opera. And they basically are saying that having Internet Explorer bundled with Windows and basically makes it's bad because people, if they already have Internet Explorer, they're not going to go out and look for a web browser and get Opera or any other web browser out there, because if you already have a web browser and you don't know what a web browser really is or why you need another one, it's not clear. The reason bundling is a bad thing is because basically Microsoft is using its market power in terms of Windows to force its way into the market for another product, basically an internet browser. Microsoft's argument on this is that no, we're not forcing our way into any markets. We're enhancing consumers' experience by providing them with a web browser that's been built in to the operating system. And they tried this line of argument for a very long time that it was completely inseparable. So it's a bit surprising to me to see that they're actually saying that they can take IE out of Windows, because this is a position that they never, as far as I know, wanted to even touch back in the Netscape antitrust litigation in the U.S.
Something I just remembered from the Netscape antitrust litigation is at some point during those motions in the trial, the judge chimed in and said, well, that's absurd. I uninstalled Internet Explorer from my own computer. And apparently the Microsoft attorney just looked very surprised at that statement.
Yes.
Never having used Windows, I can't attest to... Well, I have used it. Never having used it as my primary computer, I can't attest to whether or not it's possible to uninstall Internet Explorer from your computer.
It depends what version. For a while, you could, the early versions, but after they integrated it, you really couldn't, unless you were trying to do stuff without... You couldn't do it if you were... Just, whatever. Anyway, basically, so the EU... In this case, the EU has been supervising this case, and Microsoft has said, we're going to take out IE, we're going to unbundle it, and we're just going to sell Windows without a web browser. And the EU said, well, that's not really enough. We want you to include... That's not enough. We want you to ideally include Windows with pre-installed versions of competing web browsers. They haven't said that yet, but they've indicated that they might say that. Or... preload Windows and then let retailers decide what browsers to install. Something like that. It's just interesting because to see Microsoft finally say that we can sell Windows without a bundled browser, and then to have Europe, the EU, say that, well, that's not enough. You need to do more. In some sense, it almost seems like unbundling should be enough, because from a competitive standpoint, why should Microsoft be forced to include its competitors' products with its operating system?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It doesn't even seem like a type of remedy that would have been allowed in the United States. Usually the remedies are monetary damages for the competitors or some sort of injunction saying, you know, you can't do something. You know, you can't do uncompetitive practices anymore. You can't, you know, bundle your products anymore. You can't require that somebody... Yeah, one thing that happened fairly recently was car companies were saying if you want to maintain your car warranty, you have to use a certain brand of oil. And the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, which is one of the federal agencies that has some jurisdiction over antitrust claims, says, no, you can't do that. It's essentially a bundling. You're saying, you know, in order to use this product, in order to keep your warranty, you have to use a specific kind of motor oil. And unless you're going to provide that motor oil for free, we're not going to let you advertise and say that. I've certainly never heard of a case, although I haven't, you know, done all of the research that'd be necessary, in which a court has said, not only can't you do something, you also have to do something affirmatively. You also have to somehow help your competitors in order to remedy this. Can either of you think of an example of where that happened?
No, I certainly can't, but web browsers, as far as I know, are pretty much free, though, right? What's the rationale behind, then, of Microsoft wanting to maintain such a stronghold on the browser market like that?
I have no idea, especially given the amount of bad press that's been surrounding versions of Internet Explorer for so long about how uncompliant it is with standards and generally how buggy it is and prone to crash. I mean, I know when I use PCs, I tend to crash Internet Explorer regularly, which is why I don't use it. But yeah, as far as I know, there are no longer paid web browsers. Dominic?
I think part of the reason that EU might be doing this is because their history with the Windows Media Player unbundling. There they got Microsoft to release, as you said, a version of Windows without the Media Player, and they found that Microsoft only sold maybe 1,000 copies, in the low thousands of that version of Windows, and it didn't really increase the demand or the quality of competing media players. So the EU has basically said that their goal is to increase competition in the internet browser market, and just unbundling, they saw with the media player case, that isn't enough. So perhaps we'll see them force Microsoft to bundle competitive web browsers.
Right, but in the Windows Media Player case, not only did Microsoft have one unbundled version, they still kept their bundled version on the market. At least that's what it seems like they did. And it seems like it would be significantly better if Microsoft just distributed one copy of Windows in Europe, which was one copy of Windows without Internet Explorer on it. It doesn't seem like they'd run into that same problem that they had in the past.
Well, Microsoft's argument was, well, we don't want to cripple our software, especially when people want we'll be content to offer a version without it bundled, but we'll leave that choice up to manufacturers and retailers. If they want to buy the full version of Windows with the Media Player installed, then they can get that as in the Media Player case, only a few thousand copies were sold where people opted to get it without the Media Player version. So,
I mean, right, but what if the European Union, rather than saying you can't, you have to bundle it with a different web browser, saying
right.
You have to bundle it with no web browser and then give people... I mean, I guess the biggest problem is that I wouldn't immediately... It would be difficult to get a web browser onto a computer that doesn't already have a web browser, unless
yes.
There's some sort of program installed that would go out and download and install that for you.
Right.
I guess sort of the problem is that in doing all... In bundling these... the browsers and the media players with Windows... Microsoft has substantially foreclosed the market for other competitors, basically. So it makes it very hard for some of these third parties to create software and have people actively download them or install them on their computers.
And sort of tangential to this whole discussion of bundling, if you remember a couple of weeks ago, we had the Palm Pre and iTunes case where Palm alleged that its new Pre smartphone could sync to iTunes. Well, it turns out Apple has updated its technical support forum on iTunes with the statement that they're aware that some third parties claim that their digital media players are able to sync with Apple software, but Apple isn't going to provide support or test compatibility with. And because software changes over time, newer versions may no longer provide such syncing functionality with Apple non-Apple digital media players. In other words, they're saying to Palm, we can make your Palm Pre stop syncing with iTunes anytime we want. And if Microsoft isn't playing that sort of hardball here with the EU, where they could say that we can detect other browsers and make them just not work with Windows. And iTunes is definitely not the sort of... doesn't have the market power that Windows does. It's just a media player. But it's a good example, especially on Windows, of people installing a third-party media player, even though Windows Media Player came installed with the computer that they were running because they wanted some added functionality that media player offered. In this case, iTunes offered access to the iTunes Store, synchronization with the iPod. So I think a good message to web browsers out there is if they offer some sort of functionality that isn't available with the basic version of the web browser that ships with Windows, people will seek out that functionality and get that web browser.
I'm sorry, you attacked Apple. I'm gonna have to jump on you now. So, are you saying that Apple is engaged in some sort of illegal bundling by cutting out other?
No.
Okay.
but for in the Apple case though, I mean Apple sort of, I don't want to use the word bundling, but they include Safari, though, with all of their operating system releases, correct?
They do. That's
yes.
Definitely true.
Is that any much different, aside from the relative market positions that Microsoft and Apple have, respectively? Is that really any different from what Microsoft does?
Besides the fact that you can easily uninstall Safari from your computer, I don't think it's different at all. It's just that Apple... And the other difference is that the web browser market is very different than it was when the Netscape litigation started. I mean, now people use Firefox, they use Mozilla, they use Internet Explorer, they use Safari, they use any of the derivatives from those. You know, back then, it was Internet Explorer was the big game, and you know, Netscape was the other thing. And then there was iCab, which was the only web browser that I've ever seen that could fit on a floppy disk.
I think, you know, you can still, it's fairly easy still to disable Internet Explorer as your default browser. I don't think that's really much of an issue.
Okay.
Right.
That's fine. I don't really use PCs that much, so I can't disagree. I do know that when I've tried to disable it, I usually get a pop-up that says, every time I open it, would you like to make this your default browser? But I understand that can be turned off too if you find the preference setting for it.
In any case, it'll be interesting to see what the EU actually decides to do, and we'll keep you up to date on how this antitrust case continues and what the EU actually decides to have Microsoft do.
Right, absolutely. So thank you for listening to the Technically Legal Podcast. Signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
If you have any comments, please email us podcast@technicallylegal.org.